This is April 5th, 2015, Easter Sunday, which makes me especially glad to see so many people here. And I'm going to talk about goodness and the good this morning, reading from an article. Maybe somehow by osmosis I absorbed the season, the Christian, the joy of the season, and but in any case, here we are. This is I'm going to be reading from and commenting on an article in the current edition of Shambhala Sun. Shambhala Sun is one of the three national, international Buddhist magazines: Shambhala Sun, Tricycle, and Buddha Dharma. This is dated May of this year. And the cover story is, are people basically good? Question mark. Against the odds, Buddhism says yes. And there are three articles about the good, goodness. And the one I chose is the most down-to-earth, I think. It's by a Jeremy Adam Smith, who is edits the website of the Greater Good Science Center at the University of California, Berkeley. And the title of the article is "You Can Count on Goodness." And it says, he introduces us to the new science of human goodness. Scientists are counting up acts of goodness, and you can too. It will change the way you see life. Another reason this topic came to me is because it's just so tiresome, to put it very mildly, to be assailed every day practically with new reports of beheadings and suicide bombers and suicide pilots and mass shootings and malls and movie theaters, schools, office buildings, religious fanatics slaughtering innocents, drone attacks. How could most people not start to wonder about the basic nature of human beings when you hear about these acts of barbarism that are so spectacular and horrifying? Well, we're going to get another take on it, on that whole thing now. I'll read, I'll start just by reading, and this is Jeremy Adam Smith. I've been covering the science of human goodness off and on for almost 10 years. In that time, I've seen a dramatic transformation in how scientists understand how and why we love, thank, empathize, cooperate, and care for each other. He allows us how goodness, the word goodness, doesn't sound like a very scientific concept. But then he says, but you can count acts of goodness, and all science begins with counting. It's the counting that has started to change our understanding of human life. For example, in a study published in the January edition of the journal Mindfulness, psychologists C. Daryl Cameron and Barbara Fredrickson, so Cameron and Fredrickson, we'll hear those names again later in the article, asked 313 adults if they had helped anyone during the previous week, and 85% said they had, by, say, listening to a friend's problems, babysitting, donating to charity, or volunteering. This small study reveals a truth that is consistently demonstrated in many domains of research. The daily human life is not characterized by violence, exploitation, or indifference. Far from it. The research, that is, the counting, reveals that we care deeply for one another and that we would rather help our fellow beings than not. Even more, the science shows that refusing to help others can have debilitating, long-term mental and physical consequences for ourselves. Isolation hurts physically. So does aggression. Every angry word we utter fries neurons and wears out our hearts. I can't remember whether he says this in the article, but I'll just say it now before I forget, that these things that are reported in the media in the Middle East and Africa and elsewhere are so spectacular, they're so jarring and horrifying that's what can lead us to think that there's more evil in human beings than good. But what we don't receive in the media is the billions, and that surely is not an exaggeration, the billions of acts every day around the world that show the opposite. And surely the cumulative acts of giving and service and compassion would plausibly equal, if not exceed, the acts of evil. It's true that there are also billions of acts of pettiness and greed and anger and so forth, but at least we can't just come to conclusions really ultimately about human nature based on these horrifying things that we see every week. He continues, when I first started to write about the research, that was big news. Wow, human life isn't as bad as we thought it was. Acts of goodness yield physical rewards. Good thoughts are good for our bodies. These insights led to a lot of predictably Pollyanna-ish media coverage. But as the years went on, the science of goodness grew more complex. Scientists started to look at how the good and the bad interact. The study by Cameron and Fredrickson explores how we feel when we're helping others, and they found that quite a few participants didn't feel good at all. These people helped others out of a sense of obligation, and they felt disgust, contempt, stress, or resentment toward those they helped. Today, the science of human goodness reveals that good and bad go hand in hand, and what ties us together can also tear us apart. So the important question becomes, how can I cultivate the good? Well, the short answer that hopefully everyone who is hearing this would come up with is to develop concentration and mindfulness and live in the present. And there's more on that later in this article. In other words, for us, those of us in Zen, it's to practice Zen, not just sitting, but in our active, in our daily lives. But back to this. He cites this notorious experiment in 1971 by Philip Zimbardo, who studied the psychological effects of prison conditions. He recruited 24 young men as either guards or prisoners for a mock jail in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Building. I think that's the same building where they did the marshmallow test on kids. The results of the experiment are often cited as evidence for the innate depravity of human beings. Things went horribly wrong in the mock jail as the guards brutally abused their authority. Zimbardo himself was caught up in the inhumanity of the situation he had created. So the story of this experiment has been retold countless times, despite the fact that it's widely considered to be an example of science gone wrong, and its results have never been replicated. This is important. So why are we so fascinated by the study in evil, as Zimbardo often calls it? And why does the word evil sound so much more serious and hard-edged than good? Part of the answer lies in our natural negativity bias. This is our hardwired tendency to notice and amplify threats. I was just talking about this. It explains why so many people tend to believe that human life is brutal and cold, despite all evidence to the contrary. Negativity bias is the essence of natural selection. People who run away from a man with a gun or avoid a car running a red light are more likely to pass on their genes to the next generation. And these harrowing moments are more likely to burn themselves into our neurons than the gentle ones, so that we can avoid similar threats in the future. The Stanford prison experiment fascinates us in part because of its highly concentrated negativity. We're really good at focusing the spotlight of our attention on things we think might hurt us. But what happens when we put a spotlight on one thing? Everything else is thrown into darkness. This means we miss the good things that are outside of the spotlight. Something else happens as well. When we focus on bad things, we're triggering the stress response, often below conscious awareness. If you think of the Stanford prison experiment as a kind of miniature model of real life, if you think of yourself as living in the equivalent of that basement, then you're going to be stressed. What is stress? As another Stanford professor, Robert Sapolsky, likes to say, stress is a tool nature gave us to survive lion attacks. Of course, you're not a primate on the African savanna menaced by lions. You're a modern human who, for example, might be caught in a traffic jam. The spotlight of your attention, a mechanism built for a time when threats were much simpler, is focused only on your destination, which seems to be getting further and further away. The miracles that surround you escape your notice, like the fact that a trip that takes 60 minutes in your car would have taken your ancestors the better part of a day. So what do you do instead of appreciating the good things? Sitting in that traffic jam, you turn the other cars into lions, and you feel threatened. You might shout obscenities or scare your kids by pounding on the steering wheel. And yet, somehow, this activity does not make the cars move any faster. Instead, the stress hurts you and others mentally and physically. This evolutionary confusion is one of the tragedies of modern life. And then he offers a visualization exercise and comparing how your body feels when imagining a stressful situation as compared to imagining something good that happened, and how it makes such a difference in your bodily feelings. So what can you do? How do you bring out the good in yourself when your savanna bred instincts tell you to scream and run people over with your car? Science has an answer, and it starts with counting. The questions you have to ask yourself are these: am I counting the good things too? Am I taking the time to shine light on the things that make me happy and give my life meaning? Who thanked me today? To whom did I feel grateful? What acts of kindness or cooperation did I witness? This is the essence of that much maligned term, positive thinking. We make it a goal to count the good things in life. That doesn't mean we ignore the bad. Undeniably, there are threats in the world. There are also threats within ourselves: selfishness, laziness, short-sightedness, and so on. But all too often, our negativity bias leads us to see only the bad in other people as well as in ourselves. When we try to think positively, we are making a conscious cognitive effort to correct for our natural and understandable negativity bias. By counting the good things, we see reality more clearly. Now, I wouldn't, in terms of pure Zen practice, this would never be listed as a practice, well, at least traditionally. I'm sure that it could be good for people who have a very bleak understanding of reality. But there's another way that I think trumps this, which is to see things as neither good nor bad. It's a tall order. It's quite an assignment to see beyond good and evil. But that's ultimately where we're going in Zen practice. Last year, I think, I gave a teisho on, I read from Barbara Ehrenreich, in which she sort of deplored the rise of this positive thinking movement. And she criticized it because it can be certainly a kind of self-soothing and a way of putting on rose-colored glasses. And I said a lot of things that where I agreed with her, that we don't want to have any kind of colored glasses on. The whole point in the Dharma is to see things as they are. But that means neither good, bad, nor good. And yet here we are reading this article about how to see things more, how to count the good things. And I see, I hesitated before reading from this article because of that very bias. It's a positivity bias. And yet, I think at a time like this, maybe there's some value in presenting the other side. Even though Barbara Ehrenreich might say, well, the more we see everything as good, as a some Voltaire, Candide, said this is the best of all possible times, the danger there is that it renders us passive and complacent and unwilling to work for the betterment of society, for peace and justice. But I don't see that that needs to be the case at all. And that when we really see things as they are, then we will be prompted, we will be, if not compelled, to reach out to others and to get engaged as much as our time allows in our life. But back to this, the theme here. Sometimes seeing the good takes enormous personal strength because we need to overcome the great power of the stress-induced fight-or-flight response. Let's go back to the Stanford Prison Experiment and the career of Philip Zimbardo. His work didn't stop in 1971. As the decades went on, Zimbardo moved beyond evil. He started asking himself how to cultivate the good in people. In recent years, he has studied heroism, the willingness to make sacrifices on behalf of other people. And then he's quoted here, "The two lines of research aren't as different as they might seem. They're actually two sides of the same coin," writes Zimbardo on the Greater Good website. He continues, Zimbardo, "Some people argue humans are born good or are born good or born bad. I think that's nonsense." This is more Buddhist. This is more in accord with Buddhist understanding. "We are all born with this tremendous capacity to be anything, and we get shaped by our circumstances, by the family or the culture or the time period in which we happen to grow up. which are accidents of birth. Whether we grow up in a war zone versus peace, if we grow up in poverty rather than prosperity. This is a teaching of primary and secondary causes, of dependent co-arising. It's not just nature. It's not just nurture. It's the two working together. That statement encapsulates 30 years of scientific research into human goodness. Negativity bias isn't the whole story. There's more to us than fight or flight. The interesting thing is that even in extreme circumstances, humans will override their natural flight response. And when we do fight, we won't just fight for ourselves. We can and do fight for others. If a certain kind of person sees a child walking in front of a car, she'll put herself at risk to knock the child out of the way. Some individuals will deliberately put themselves between a gun and other people. We read this, you know, we read this, and it's the stories, the horrific stories of school shootings and other things like this, to the degree that we have access to the information of these incidents, we often do read about heroic acts of people. He continues, we can and do override our short-term self-interest all the time. Every day, some of us put ourselves in harm's way so that others can live. That heroic impulse is what Zimbardo now studies. He has researched who is most likely to commit heroic acts, and the prosaic answers include black people more than whites, those who have experienced violence or disaster before, and people with more education. But he has also found that heroism is a skill. People are more likely to make sacrifices on behalf of others when they've made a conscious commitment to heroism and are trained to act heroically. Again, the importance in Zen practice of training. And I'm not talking about, you know, residential training at the Zen Center, but training our acting and overcoming our habitual resistances, our habitual inertia, and having the courage to respond when responding is called for. This is how we change. It's by doing things, by acting, responding, not standing back and observing things in front of us. And then he just mentions that on his website, the Greater Good Science Center, they've launched a new site, Greater Good in Action, which offers concrete research-tested practices for individuals to cultivate strengths like awe, gratitude, empathy, and compassion. This is the work of a lifetime. Changing yourself is no simple task. And changing the world, that can seem impossible. And then he mentions Barbara Ehrenreich. Writers like Barbara Ehrenreich and Oliver Berkman have criticized positive thinking as a tool of social control. If you're grateful for everything, they ask, how can you possibly see what's wrong in the world? If you're always being mindful, that is, cultivating non-judgmental focus on the present, how can you plan for the future? Of course, there's no conflict between that. When you need to plan for the future, you do that mindfully. Does a focus on perfecting yourself mean that you ignore improving society? Then the author says, I think it's true that these are dangers to guard against, but research like Zimbardo's, of which includes nonviolent civil disobedience as an example of heroism, finds specific steps we can take to develop a more caring society, one the critics might dismiss as self-centered or wishful thinking. Remember the study of helping behavior by Cameron and Fredrickson that I mentioned at the beginning? They hypothesized that two mindful traits, a focus on the present moment and a non-judgmental acceptance of thoughts and experiences, would help people feel better about helping others. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. The research confirmed their hypothesis. Present focused attention and non-judgmental acceptance both predicted more helping behavior. Mindful participants were more likely to experience emotions like compassion, joy, or elevation while giving help. In part, this was because mindfulness helped them to put their own anxiety aside in order to focus on the needs of others. That's a good one. Let's repeat that. Mindfulness helped them to put their own anxiety aside in order to focus on the needs of others. Yeah, when we're less self-absorbed in our cocoon of thoughts about ourselves, most of them are about ourselves, then we're more likely to respond. They just felt better when helping people, which likely led them to engage in more helping behavior in general. It's a result echoed in other studies. Paul Condon of Northeastern University and his colleagues put study participants through an 8-week mindfulness course. After the course, the meditators were called into a waiting room with no empty seats. An actress working for the researchers limped in on crutches and leaned against a wall. The researchers created the same situation for a group who didn't go through the mindfulness course. Here's what they found. Okay, listen up. Members of the group that studied mindfulness meditation were 5 times more likely to give up their seat to the woman on crutches than those who didn't. I'm thinking here of the koan in the Blue Cliff record, number 89, the hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, which also came to mind this morning in anticipation of our guest speaker giving a talk on the Bodhisattva of Compassion right after Taisho this morning. Where these two Zen masters are talking. Ungan asked Dogo, "What use does the great Bodhisattva of Compassion make of all those hands and eyes?" This is a traditional iconography of the Bodhisattva of Compassion. Kanon, Avalokiteshvara, Guanyin, is to be shown with covered with eyes in the head, eyes and arms, multi-armed. It's one of the figures of Kanon. So what use does she make of all those hands and eyes? Dogo said, "It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night." Ungan said, "I understand." Dogo said, "How do you understand it?" Ungan said, "The whole body is hands and eyes." I'm just going to, there's a little bit more in the koan, but it will detract from the point I'm making now, which is that all of us in our essential nature are covered with hands and eyes. We are hands and eyes. We have the eyes to see things as they are, beyond both pessimism and optimism, but to see things as they are. And when we do, then we reach out, no-mindedly. It's like someone like being asleep. The conscious mind, the mind that worries and draws conclusions about human nature, the mind that divides into good and bad, when that mind is quiet, then it's like, and responding to those in need is like reaching back, groping for a pillow with an outstretched hand in the middle of the night. Wonderful analogy. Wonderful. Encouraging analogy. The upshot of these two, I'm reading again, the upshot of these two studies, that is on mindfulness and responsiveness, is that cultivating awareness of your own thoughts, feelings, and surroundings makes you more likely to see and meet the needs of others. Mindfulness is also linked to greater compassion for ourselves. In other words, mindful people are quicker to comfort themselves when they screw up. The critics might think they're just letting themselves off the hook, but the research says otherwise. "We think we need to beat ourselves up if we make mistakes so that we won't do it again," said University of Texas psychologist Kristen Neff. "But that's completely counterproductive. Self-criticism is very strongly linked to depression, and depression is antithetical to motivation. You're unable to be motivated to change if you're depressed. It causes you to lose faith in yourself, and that's going to make you less likely to try to change and conditions you for failure." Yeah, try this sometime. "Make you less likely to try to change and conditions you for failure." I would have put a comma there myself. So, yes, of course. We're quicker to comfort ourselves when we screw up. I don't know about the word comfort, but we screw up doing zazen. We screw up relentlessly. We're always losing the awareness of the practice every 3 minutes or 3 seconds. And in order to keep sitting, we have to make peace with the fact that we keep screwing up all the time. And then we eventually stop criticizing ourselves and get to the real work, which is just returning the mind to the practice and not launching into a dialogue, an inner dialogue about how incompetent we are in this meditation. We do this enough thousands of times of returning to the practice, and then we start to ease up on ourselves outside the Zendo as well. And that means that we ease up on others. Always, what we're doing to ourselves, we're doing to others. The way we view ourselves is how we view others. Because self and other are not two. Of course, it's natural that whatever self-esteem or lack of self-esteem, whatever we're doing to ourselves in the mind, we're going to externalize that. So this is the whole premise of meditation. This is how we change our own understanding of this self that is no self, and how we then that goes into responding to others, and that's another way of changing the world, by the way. They continue in the article, "Mindfulness and self-compassion are also turning out to be tools to correct for different forms of implicit bias, such as racial discrimination." I went into this some in the Zembo article I wrote a year or two ago, a Zembo issue on racism. "This shouldn't surprise us. Too often we believe that people are either racist or not, but new research finds that's just not true. As David Amodio, Susan Fisk, and other scientists have documented, everyone is prone to knee-jerk bias. The trick is to cultivate enough self-awareness to know when you are being biased, to see the world as it is, not fear, not what we fear it is. Research, this is a Berkeley psychologist, Rodolfo Mendoza Denton. Research consistently shows that we can override our automatic associations through our behavior and can even unlearn our automatic associations with enough practice. Thus, we're not simply either egalitarian or prejudiced. Egalitarianism is a learned skill. This is what I hate about the word racist, or any ist, actually, is that it's a noun, and that implies a fixedness, a permanence. And there is no such thing in the Dharma, in reality. None of us is stuck with who we are, what we are. Such a misguided, yes, describe language or behavior as racist language or behavior, but not people, because there are no people, there are no fixed selves out there. But it's such a inflammatory and powerful kind of accusation to say you're a racist. He continues, several studies find that even very brief training for young white people in mindfulness seems to limit unconscious negative reactions to black faces. This is perhaps because awareness of one's own impulses can help us to override them. Many police departments are now training officers to be aware of the implicit biases that influence split-second decision-making. To me, nothing better reveals the relationship between our inner lives and our social reality than the fight against implicit bias. Given the pervasive impact of racism, from the psychological insecurity it creates in minority communities to the huge gaps in wealth between different racial groups, I think we all have a responsibility to search inside ourselves for signs of bias. But it can't stop at just recognizing the problem. We also have to find the good in ourselves. We can start by recognizing that bias toward your own group isn't a sign of your innate evil. It's a sign that you're human. The next step is to forgive yourself, for these are feelings that all human beings have at one time or another. The very idea of forgiveness always implies that change is possible. When we grow as individuals, we grow as a species. Okay, this is just the conclusion. I'm going to leave that off and go to what is beyond the good and the bad. And here I'm drawing from another koan. This is number 6 in the Blue Cliff record. Every day is a good day. Umon addressed the assembly, saying, I don't ask you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what about after the 15th? Give me a word about those days. And then apparently there was no answer, because Umon himself answered for everyone. Every day is a good day. Now, you know he can't mean that every day, everything is the best it possibly could be. He can't be using the word good as it stands apart from bad. He can't be speaking dualistically. And we have to acknowledge that this whole article I just read is using the word as good in opposition to bad, and that's its limitation. It has its limitations, and again, I read it because I think we can sometimes achieve some balance in our perspective by seeing the other side of bad. But again, can we go beyond both good and bad? That's what Umon is doing here when he says every day is a good day. It goes to what I'm reminded of is the central natural koan for the Japanese Zen master Basui, or was it Bankei? Bright Virtue, yeah, Bankei. I always mix up Bankei and Basui, both Japanese Zen masters, where Bankei, as a young man, heard a priest refer to bright virtue, and it plunged him into questioning, what is bright virtue? And he struggled with this for years before coming to enlightenment. But here the word virtue is not used in the way that we normally think of virtue. I think most people, when they hear virtue, they think of goodness or morality. But another definition in our own English dictionary for virtue is effective power or force, efficacy, potency. And that's the power of our true nature. It's the power of our original self. And yet another koan in the Mumonkan, this was, is the story of the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, fleeing the monks led by the fierce monk Myo, who thought that he had gotten away with the Dharma treasures, the robe and the bowl. And finally Myo caught up with Wei Nung. Wei Nung turned, put the robe in the bowl that he had received in Dharma transmission from the fifth patriarch, laid it on the rock, laid them on the rock, and said, just symbols. Go ahead, take them. And Monk Myo broke down. He was kind of paralyzed. And he said, I'm not asking for the robe, but I want the Dharma. And to which Wei Nung said, when you're thinking of neither good nor evil, what is the original self of Monk Myo? That's ultimately what we can aspire to in Zen practice, is yes, use expedient means, skillful means as we may need to. If we're getting depressed about the state of the world and ourselves, then yes, you can do some self-talk and do some counting of acts of compassion and service. What floated up in my mind this morning, among many other things, is the tremendous ethic in the United States of volunteerism. There's nothing like this known in Europe, at least. Many Europeans have said this is one of the something distinctive about Americans, and this too can balance what for some of us can come to be a pretty negative understanding of American and its vices. But this volunteerism, it's going on everywhere in this country all the time. And surely it's in other countries too. I don't know about that, but here it is such a strong tradition. This is good, if you use those words, good and bad. It's many wonderful things that are done all the time, countless, by us human beings. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.